This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good morning and welcome to the 2013 Philomathia Forum on Water Society, Water Climate and Society, Challenges and Strategies in a Rapidly Changing World. My name is David Ackerley. I'm a professor in the Department of Integrative Biology and the chair of today's event. And organized it together with David Sedlak of Civil and Environmental Engineering. Water serves the most basic of human needs, from the glass of drinking water, so easily taken for granted, to the rains that support the farms, fish, and forests of our blue planet. At the same time, too much water can sweep away livelihoods, and too little leaves crops wilted in the field. Building a sustainable and resilient society in the 21st century is our greatest challenge. A century in which the human population is expected to peak, even as a changing climate disrupts the very foundations of modern society. Critical decisions will be made in the next 10 to 20 years that chart the course of human well-being in this century. And here at Berkeley, as at all the world's great universities, we carry a responsibility to rise to this challenge. Today's symposium brings together leading voices from inside and outside the university to examine the intersection of water, climate, and society, and to identify opportunities for university research to inform decision makers as they grapple with the societal challenges we face in this century. To open today's event, it is my honor to introduce Chancellor Nicholas Dirks. Chancellor Dirks became the 10th Chancellor of the University of California, Berkeley, on June 1st, 2013. An internationally renowned historian and anthropologist, he is a leader in higher education, and well known for his commitment to and advocacy for accessible, high-quality undergraduate education in the liberal arts and sciences. Chancellor Dirks is committed to engaging the campus community in a collective effort to imagine new futures for the university, to ensure the quality and centrality of undergraduate education, to sustain our vanguard position in graduate and professional education, and to connect our research work to the public good. Chancellor Dirks, thank you for joining us, and welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you, David, and welcome to this critically important conference today. I'm delighted that you've joined us, and I am extremely grateful to the Philomathia Foundation for their consistent support of the University of California in Berkeley on these absolutely key strategic priorities. I'd like to thank all the faculty who have been part of the development of the symposium, especially David Ackerley and David Sedlak from the Department of Environmental and Civil Engineering. They co-chaired the faculty committee that organized the symposium this year. But back to the Philomathia Foundation, the foundation's contributions to supporting science at UC Berkeley, especially in the energy and environment arena, have greatly advanced our research activities in so many fields. And it's fitting, indeed, that we can link the science that we have here to the kinds of issues that this conference and symposium is addressing, thanks to their support. I'd also like to thank the keynote speakers, panelists, moderators, and student rapporteurs from the Graduate School of Journalism for participating in the exciting program today. And thanks also to the many researchers who were involved in creating the poster displays in the gallery. Today, I think we all agree and understand that water is a critical, if still relatively poorly understood, component of the global climate system, and that our changing climate will reshape the global distribution of water resources in ways that are unprecedented in recorded human history. How we face these challenges will have an enormous impact on our future and on many future generations to come. This event is extremely timely with the release of the latest IPCC report on how much warming and glacial melting Earth can expect in the future. And it's just as well a little over a year after Hurricane Sandy hit New York. I just came here from New York City, and that experience was a real altering experience for those of us in New York City who saw water completely inundate the lower part of Manhattan and change the way we thought about climate for good. UC Berkeley scientists and their international colleagues gather here today to discuss how to adapt to these and related changes and how to address the enormous challenges ahead in terms of the supply of water and clean water for consumption and water resources for agriculture. Now, Berkeley has a long tradition of multidisciplinary research that transcends traditional departmental boundaries. In this environment, faculty collaborate with each other to provide technical solutions, to understand financial markets, regulatory frameworks, and political obstacles. Only this kind of approach enables us to provide the integrated solutions necessary for the challenges ahead. Many faculty in the department spanning the range of this university are actively engaged in the areas that flow, as it were, from today's concentration on water. And because of the deep intellectual diversity that exists at Berkeley, we are able to advance solutions to the issues of water, climate change, and social well-being in new, innovative, and indeed absolutely critical ways that will, I hope, have a lasting impact for many years ahead. It is now my distinguished honor to introduce our keynote speaker, former mayor of Los Angeles, lifelong dedicated public servant, Antonio Villa-Raygoza. Our speaker, while attending the University of California in Los Angeles, established himself early on in a tradition that we embrace here at Berkeley as well, as a student leader in civil rights and in the anti-war movement. As a union organizer, labor leader, and speaker of the California Assembly, he earned the admiration of allies and adversaries alike with his formidable skills for building consensus across party lines, ethnic divides, and other kinds of boundaries. As mayor, he emerged as a dynamic and indeed national spokesperson for sustainability, green growth, and increasing investment in America's cities. Some of the highlights of his administration include action that pushed urban water use down about 20% from where it was when he took office. He implemented aggressive strategies to meet the Kyoto Protocol for reducing greenhouse gases 4 years ahead of schedule. And by the end of his second term, the city was using 20%, was getting only 20% of its energy from, getting up to 20% of its energy, I'm sorry, from renewable sources. And having visited Los Angeles regularly over the last 20 years, because my mother is there, I've seen the visible result of changes in air quality that I think our mayor deserves special credit for. We are very fortunate to have you with us today, so please join me in welcoming Antonio Villa-Raygoza.
Thank you, Chancellor Dirks. I was asking, as I got here a little early, why a group of esteemed academics would invite a practitioner here in the way that you have. And someone said, well, we identify problems and you fix them. I don't know if that's true, but I do know that whenever I'm asked about great cities and what the characteristics of a great city are, a global city like an LA, I always say they're anchored by great institutions of higher learning. And I'm very happy to be here at Berkeley. Once again, I was here, I think, when I lost the mayor's race in 2001. So I guess you're keeping me employed, if you will, in that period of time. And I noticed this is going in and out. Excuse me. This is going in and out. Good. It's okay now. I actually wanted to speak from there because I saw I couldn't bring notes up here with this apparatus. So I'm ready to speak from wherever. Great institutions of higher learning anchor great cities. And what you heard a little, and I'm going to share with you a little more about what we did around climate change and water. Obviously, energy issues in LA. But we couldn't have done as much as we did if we didn't have, great institutions, UCLA, Caltech, SC, Anchoring. Our adaptation study, which I'll talk about in a minute, was performed by Alex Hall at UCLA. It is indeed an honor to be here. And let me share with you from a practitioner's view, and particularly in a place like LA. I always say if I had been in San Francisco, we actually probably could have done even more. But, you know, we had a lot of pushback on the things we did. When I started out as mayor in 2005, I said, dream with me. We're going to make LA the cleanest, greenest big city in America. Now, most of you know at that time, LA and still has dirty air in comparison to other cities. We're in a city known for smog and not sustainability. And so when they panned the audience when I said that, you saw a number of elected officials, by the way, a couple of them from Northern California, they smirked when I said we would make LA the cleanest, greenest big city in America. Well, a few days later, we signed on to Kyoto. About 150 mayors had signed on to Kyoto back then. There are now, as I understand it, close to 1,200 who have signed on to Kyoto in a country that still hasn't signed on to Kyoto. And as you know, Kyoto says you'll reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 7% of 1990 levels by 2012. When we committed to that, I mean, virtually everyone said, well, good luck. Well, as you heard, we not only hit the Kyoto goals, we're the number one American city, 28% below Kyoto levels, number five in the world. We did that in the following ways. One, we also made a commitment to go. If you don't know LA, LA owns a public utility. It's different than the Bay Area. I think you have PG&E here. We own the Department of Water and Power. So we were about 3.8% renewables back then. The dirtiest, not only the largest public utility in the United States of America, but the dirtiest public utility in the United States of America, about 50% reliant on coal. So we said we were going to get to 20% renewables by 2010. Well, this was 2005. The notion of getting from 3.8 to 20% renewables seemed to most people something that wouldn't or couldn't happen. By 2010, I'm happy to announce, you mentioned it in my introduction, the Department of Water and Power hit the 20% threshold. By 2009, we were conserving 19 times the energy that we were before. At the port, and if you know anything about LA, and I'll talk about the port again when I talk about the climate adaptation study, at the port, we move 44% of all the seaborne goods that enter the United States of America. So Oakland's a big entry, but it's nothing like LA. It's LA, Long Beach, 44% of all the seaborne goods. It's also other than cars, one of the biggest generators of pollutants, SOx, NOx, PM, all generated because of that port activity. So almost immediately, I said, well, look, if we're going to reduce our carbon emissions, we're going to have to clean up our port. The business of a port, we move 44% of the GDP of the goods that enter the United States of America, and it's a big part of the LA, Southern California GDP. So the business community said, you do these things to reduce pollutants at the port, and you're going to kill business. And, of course, my friends, the environmental community, who I love sometimes, they said, we've got to green the port at all costs because the public health implications of port activity is such that respiratory diseases, asthma and the like, lost school days, is a cost to the economy as well. So one side said we got to grow the port at all costs. But by the way, when they tried to grow the port, they were stymied in lawsuits for years by the environmental community and the public health community. And so bottom line is we came together. We said you can't grow a port if you're not greening it. You can't green a port if you're not growing it. And today, LA, Long Beach, but it started in LA, LA has the most far-reaching effort to clean up a port, not in the United States of America, but the world. A 90% reduction in truck emissions, a 76% reduction in SOx, a 71% reduction in PM, and a 51% reduction in SOx. About a 50% reduction when you look at it in all pollutants. Historic and game-changing and a big contributor to how LA reduced its carbon emissions by 28%. But, of course, that wasn't enough. We also said, because almost immediately when I went to conferences like this, by the way, almost immediately people would say, well, yeah, you're at 20% renewables, and yes, you have a far-reaching effort to clean up a port, but you're still the dirtiest public utility because you've gone from 49 or 50% relying on coal to only 39% relying on coal. And until you get off of coal, you really have done nothing important with respect to addressing climate change in this town. And so what we did, we signed at the instigation of the Sierra Club, we signed a series of agreements that are all done, Al Gore at our side. By 2025, LA will be completely off of coal. As I understand it, the only American city our size that I can think of, maybe some of you know some others, and game-changing with respect to our reliance on fossil fuels. Now, of course, as soon as I did that, the first question that was asked, well, what are you going to replace that 39% coal with? And, of course, it will be renewables. We're now at 20%. We'll be at 33 by 2020. We'll be out of one coal-fired plant in 2015, the other by, we said 2025, but we expect by 2022. The question was asked, what will you replace it with? And, of course, we'll replace it with renewables. We expect to be at 33% renewables by then, but also natural gas. And, of course, the first question is, are you fracking to get some of that natural gas? And the answer was, yes, we are, for some of it. That didn't go well with some people, but the fact of the matter is we're getting completely off of coal. How else did we address climate change in LA? And I'll get to water in a bit, but we focused a lot more on air quality because of the fact that LA was so known for the dirtiest air. We went to San Francisco and saw that they had one of the toughest green building standards in the United States of America. We patterned our own after San Francisco. Obviously, we're five times bigger. So that has generated, I think we have more LEED certified buildings, as I understand it, or at least more square footage under with LEED certification than any major American city. We've started a clean roof, a green roof and a cool roof program, much as Chicago has done. They pretty much have led the way. We have retrofitted governmental buildings, kind of energizing that effort. And if somebody can get me a glass of water, that would be good, since I'm keynoting and I understand they'd like, thank you, me to speak a few minutes longer. Water is key. That was his, not mine. I used it. Anyway. Oh, thank you. You're very kind. more water is even better. So we then did a couple other things. 4,500 traffic signals in LA. Every single one today, every single one, LED lights. Synchronized every single light in LA. You wouldn't know it by the gridlock we have, but only American city, every single light, only American, large American city, there may be some small ones, only American city, every single light. And if I would have been able to have a presentation here, I would have been told you how many. I think it's a million. It's a big number what it does to climate change. Our carbon emissions. But then with the Clinton Global Initiative, they gave us an idea. They said, you know, you have 140,000 street lamps. What if you retrofitted every single one of those incandescent bulbs with LED? Do you know what you would save over time? I said, well, we don't have the money to do that. That's going to cost us millions. Well, actually, we could bond against the savings, and we had some bond people demonstrate how. Today, LA, every single modern lamp, there's the old lamps that we have that we will have to do, the next mirror we'll have to do. But 140,000 street lamps. I think Guangzhou is number two at 66,000, number one city in the world. And then we did something else. Because you all know LA is known for its addiction to the single passenger automobile. In fact, Jennifer Walsh was now here at Berkeley, was with me when invited me to SC. I went to SC when I lost the mayor's race in 2001. We put together a booklet called Beyond Sprawl, and in it we talked about growing greener, we talked about growing safer, growing more civic-minded, growing together, and that became the blueprint for what we did in the 8 years that I was mayor. I'm now at SC chairing the Center for the Restoration of the California Dream, which will be a blueprint for something else, but we'll talk about that another time. I saw you didn't get that. Yeah, think about it. But so we then said, look, LA's too addicted to the single passenger automobile. LA used to have a very robust public transportation system in the 1930s and 40s. We dismantled it, some say, because of the rubber industry and the auto industry. And I don't know. We built a bunch of freeways that we immediately filled up. And, you know, gridlock is the answer. So, you know, I said, well, why don't we start building public transit again? And, of course, everybody smirked and looked at me and they said, that's a $40 billion proposition. That's not going to happen in L.A., not in the middle of a recession. We put a half-penny sales tax. You know, in California, I don't have to tell you, we're all Californians. We're one of those states that you need a two-thirds threshold to pass a tax and a bond. And notwithstanding that, we got the two-thirds of the L.A. area to support a $40 billion effort to rebuild public transportation in L.A., in the 8 years that I was mayor, we opened up 3 light rail lines, 1 busway. We're in construction in 4 more. We have a plan to accelerate 30 years of funding. It was supposed to be 10 years, but maybe a 15-year period of time. Game-changing with respect to climate change. Everything that we're doing and every planning decision that's made in the city is made with a focus on public transportation along corridors. I don't have to tell the urban planners here that that's what every other city in the world has been doing for decades. LA's finally come into the 21st century. We build along density, along transit lines, density along transit stations, creating neighborhoods, and incentivizing development. What have we done around water, which I know is the primary focus of what you did, of what you're doing today? Well, almost from the beginning, well, first of all, when I ran in 2001, we were on a path to do water recycling, not just for parks and golf courses, but water recycling for, you know, for home use. Orange County is doing it. Other cities do it. It got mired in mayoral politics and demagoguery, and they killed a very important program that I brought partially back once I became mayor. Some of the problems that we're going to face, and they called it the water recycling program, toilet to tap. So obviously that didn't go very well. Almost, you know, I was focused primarily, as I said, on, you know, air quality and our carbon emissions. And that's what drove most of what I did in the 8 years as mayor. But then we got a bit of a crisis. You know, I don't have to tell you that the Eastern Sierras ain't what it used to be. I don't have to tell you because, you know, L.A. stole, much as San Francisco did. They didn't get beat up for it the way we have, but L.A. stole the water from the Owens Valley, and we've been paying ever since. We've been in these water wars with them. And, of course, once I became mayor, I said, we got to settle the war. We got to settle these lawsuits. We recharge the water there in the Owens Valley. You could actually get on a canoe there from time to time. We have to do dust mitigation, and that's where I've pushed back a bit. It's very costly and wasteful of water. We were ordered to do that, and we keep on getting ordered to do more of that. We are working out, I think, an agreement where we'll be able to do this in a smarter way, protect the Owens Valley, but also provide more water to people who use it. Now, LA uses the same amount of water today that we did in 1970 when we had more than a million, when we had a million less people. While I was mayor, we reduced water use by 20%. This is where you need a practitioner, by the way, because there was pushback. Like I said, if I had lived in San Francisco, we might have been a little more successful. In the middle of, we used to get most of our water from the Owens Valley and other places, not as much water from MWD. I think we were getting like 24%. We're now at 50% water from Metropolitan Water District, too expensive. And we're trying to reduce that amount, and we put some strategies to do that. But one thing we did in the middle of a one of our droughts, I ordered LA homeowners to only water twice a week. That, you know, in LA, I don't, you know, for those, well, up here too, but particularly in LA, people in the San Fernando Valley, it's almost like it's a desert. I mean, you get temperatures of 110 and 105 fairly frequently. You know, people pretty much think they have a birthright to their pool and to their large expansive lawns. So when the mayor said, you will only be able to water twice a week, that didn't go over very well. But we did it anyway. I got the city council that pushed back after a lot of resistance from homeowners over the a few, you know, 6 month period of time to 3 days a week, but we still only can water 3 days a week in a city where we used to water 7 days a week before. You could water in the middle of the day. You could water at any time during the day. Now you have to water at certain periods where it makes more sense, where the water doesn't dissipate as quickly. We've done a adaptation study. I think we're the first major American city to do an adaptation study, because we said, you know, we're doing a lot around climate change, particularly the energy side, but we're not really kind of doing it, understanding where are we going to be in 50 years. We knew that the UN had done an adaptation study, and I know I'm talking academics. I wish Alex was here, because Alex knows more about that adaptation study than I ever do. I just ordered it had the foresight to do that. Come on in. This is just a talk. But I knew early on, and particularly because of the resistance we were getting with almost everything we were doing, because when we went to 20% renewables, if you followed the fight, LA rate payers said it was too expensive. And, of course, the demagogues on my city council joined, even though we were paying less at the DWP than the investor-owned utility down the way. But people also think they have a birthright to the lowest energy cost anywhere. So, you know, most of this stuff had resistance. I'm just cutting short for all of you. We didn't just get to these goals without a lot of business resistance, without a lot of homeowner resistance, without a lot of pushback from my colleagues on the city council. And I love them, because they would always be there when we would announce we're at 20% renewables, we're getting off of coal, and then the next day question how come it costs so much. But that's the life of a mayor. So when we did the water adaptation, the thinking behind it, and I've got to credit, of course, Romel Pasquale, my deputy mayor, and Nancy Sutley, who was with me, who went on to the Obama administration. I was very blessed to have the best and the brightest with us. But the adaptation study was important, and the reason why I ordered it was the following. I said, look, we're getting so much pushback on everything we're doing. We're going to have to lay out to LA what's going to happen. You know, because climate change for a lot of people, whether it's on the water side of the interstate, it's very abstract. What's going to happen to LA in 50 years? Well, historically, these adaptation studies are very academics who understand them better than I do. But as I understand them, they would cover, there wasn't a lot of, let me see how I would explain it. There wasn't a lot of specificity in let's say, as an example, 120 square mile radius. We, working with Professor Hall, kind of came up with a model that allowed us to look at microclimates. So we were able to look at what downtown was going to look like. We were able to look at what Santa Monica and Venice were going to look like. We were able to look at what Hancock Park was going to look like, what Woodland Hills, Studio Cities. And if you don't know these places, this is all L.A. You know, L.A. is known. Hollywood is L.A. Santa Monica's not, by the way. But that's another story. So we put this water, and I said, look, I want you to explain to academe, but particularly to the practitioners, what's going to happen if we don't do more around water recycling, water reclamation projects, urban runoff? What's going to happen if we don't do more around carbon emission in LA? And it came back, a fairly seminal study, and told us the following. You know, in downtown LA, we're going to have three times the hot days that we used to. In the San Fernando Valley, four times. In the high desert, five times. You know, you're going to see temperatures in particularly the San Fernando Valley and the high desert that heretofore we hadn't seen. You're going to see the possibility with climate change, you're going to see the possibility that the nation's busiest airport, number one destination airport, LAX, could be inundated with water. Venice will be inundated with water. The port of LA, 44% of all inundated with water. If we don't do things around climate change. So as I've said, and I'll end with, because I know that Lisa Jackson's here and rather hear from our EPA director. Of course, I will say this about cities and the national government. And that's what I was going to, it's a good entree into. You know, we were at Copenhagen when President Obama and all the national presidents, all the national governments were there. And I tell people, if you care about climate change, you need to go to the cities. And maybe that's why you invited me. Because at Copenhagen, you didn't know, but the mayors of the great cities were there. L.A., New York, London, Mexico City, Paris, Rome. I believe Shanghai and Hong Kong were there. Tokyo was there. The mayors of the big cities were all there. The presidents and the national governments were there as well. The presidents were pointing fingers at one another, engaging in the blame game, you know, who's done more to bring us to where we're at. You want me to do more than I should, even though I'm just starting out and you're already, a well-developed, industrialized nation, you know, that kind of thing. We're also going like this, but to see who could outdo one another. So London and L.A., as an example, both bought into the Clinton Global Initiative to retrofit their street lamps. I think they're at 24,000. We are at 140, but, you know, but they've reduced carbon emissions by more than L.A. I think they're at 40%. We're at 28. So I would submit to you, whether it's issues of water or climate change, carbon emissions, I would submit to you that if academe wants to get things done, they need to go to mayors, and particularly the mayors of the big cities, of the, you know, New York, Chicago, L.A., Shanghai, Mexico. All of us are trying to outdo one another. We just are. It's the way of the world. We're all looking at best practices. We talked, you know, Beijing can learn from L.A. We had the dirtiest air in the United States of America. And I know we're ending, but one last thing. Why is this relationship important? One of the things we started doing when we got so much pushback, we said, okay, maybe we're going to end some jobs in this sector of the economy, but we're going to create jobs in this sector. So almost immediately, I went to Chancellor Block, UCLA. I went to President Sample and then Nikias at SC. I went to the head of Caltech, and I said, we need to work together. We need to, one, document what we're doing. We need to, two, we need to do things smarter, because one of the ways I got to 20% renewables is I bought on the spot market, and that wasn't smart. We need to do things smarter. We need to identify where the best practices are and adopt them. We need to apply for national grants at the federal government. I'm the mayor. I've got a close relationship with the White House. We need to be, every time you write a grant, the mayor should get behind it and advocate for it. We need to create a clean tech corridor and an innovation center, the LaCrette Center, that we broke construction so that we're developing the technologies that will clean up our city and then clean up cities around the world and make us a clean tech center. I would submit to you, whether it's water or carbon emissions, if we don't develop those technologies and take advantage of creating the jobs around that, we've missed the boat. That's why the national government is mired in partisan politics, the only country in the world where people are debating climate change, right? At the halls of Congress, where they're not doing it in the cities, and they're not doing it in these institutions of higher learning. So that's kind of what we did over an 8-year period of time.
I wish I could tell you we did a lot more about around water, but we did some. But I think this adaptation study, it was important because of the following, and finally. And that is, the things we did to suggest that people do going into the future, they're going to have to do in the future. It won't just be a suggestion. They're going to have to do it. And you all will provide the evidence for that. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.